Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, America burning. So, Richard, so much has transpired since last we talked last week. The country is now racked with protests, many of them devolving into what are essentially riots, and all of this precipitated by a confrontation that occurred on Memorial Day between Minneapolis police and a black man named George Floyd, who the police had been called on the suspicion that he was using counterfeit currency. And so Floyd, after being handcuffed, is held to the ground by a police officer who is keeping him down by placing his knee on Floyd's neck, cuts off his ability to breathe. Floyd dies in the process, and this becomes a national outrage because the whole event, including onlookers who are telling the cops that this is excessive and that they're impairing his ability to breathe, this whole thing is caught on video and ends up going viral. So there's a lot for us to work through here today. Why don't we start with the specific police conduct there? So all four officers at the scene, there are three others who are standing by while this is happening, they're all fired from the Minneapolis police force. Derek Chauvin, the officer who was actually performing the hold, was charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Now, Floyd's family has said that they were disappointed that the charges weren't more serious. In the atmosphere of indignation around this case, you've had people claim that this should be first-degree murder, which is probably representative of the fact that a lot of lay people seem to think that these categories are just based on how offensive the crime is. But walk us through these charges and whether you think they're justified, whether they make sense.
Lord does not know. The first thing, of course, is that there are three other people there who probably should be charged with something as well. They were all part of a single group. They have mutual responsibilities towards one another. To sit there and to watch this kind of a disgraceful episode take place and do nothing to try and dissuade your calling from that is, I think, close enough to participation. Generally, there's no duty on the part of a stranger to intervene, but policemen are not strangers when they're working as part of teams. So nobody would ever say that the people who are bystanders watching this appalling event going on were in any sense responsible for anything that had happened. And indeed, it would have been an interesting question if they had tried to intervene in order to force the breakup of the situation. They may have well been arrested, Lord knows for what. All the categories with respect to murder and so forth, dealing with premeditation, different kinds of mens rea, are extremely difficult to understand for a layman. And they're even more difficult to understand the moment you say that you're talking about somebody who, in principle, always has some degree of a justification for the kinds of things that he or she does. That is, police officers are supposed to use force in order to restrain other individuals. And nobody would say that it was a case of false imprisonment if they had put the cuffs on him and had walked him away into the van. So there have been a lot of calls for saying that we have to get rid of police immunity in order to make sure that situations like this don't happen. But that leads to the absurd situation that every time there's arrest, there's a potential lawsuit, no matter how it's been carried out. So the rule has always been, it's not that you have a particular intention or not. The question is, how closely did you follow the rules and the established practices? And so there's no question that if you use the same amount of force with somebody who is trying to kill you and you had not subdued him, there would be no difficulty under these circumstances. The difficulty in all of these cases is this thing, to use the standard term, violative of the clearly established norms for good police behavior. And there have been a number of recent cases that have attracted a lot of ire by a lot of people in which it seems as though people have gotten off when they should not have been able to get off. So there's a fairly strong left-right consensus, the libertarians on both sides. Remember, on these issues, somebody like Neil Gorsuch and Soto Sotomayor actually sound alike, to saying that you have to take a much closer look at the claims for immunities in individual cases, even if you keep the basic framework, which I regard as the correct approach. But since you have this justification issue, as well as the question of intent issues, it's going to be very muddy. The other thing about this is not standard first-degree murder, because nobody has claimed that Chauvin has really did this with the sole purpose of seeking to kill that particular person out of some kind of vendetta or spite. So what happens is the mental state that's involved here is not, willfulness, bringing about the very consequence that happened to your heart's delight. It's a situation where you thought you had some weak kind of a justification, which you exceeded, resulted in a consequence that you may not have intended. I don't think there's anybody who actually claimed that he wanted to kill this particular person. And if he did, then that would be first-degree murder under these circumstances. So it's this interplay of justification on the one hand and knowledge on the other hand that makes these things into second and third-degree cases. Was there any provocation in this case? Because sometimes murder induced by provocation is reduced to manslaughter. Doesn't seem as though there was any provocation that's worth talking about. The whole thing was completely appalling. And the good news is there is nobody on any side of the political spectrum that wanted to defend this particular action as being consistent with police protocol. So the real issue is, has the system broken down? And here, this is Epstein's rule, and I'll just cut this one point. It's the rule of large numbers. We have thousands upon thousands of policemen making thousands upon thousands of arrests. There is no way when you have these decentralized systems that you can prevent aberrant actions like this from taking place 100% of the time. So you're going to get one of these cases or something like this every year, every 6 months, every 3 months. And we all remember every one of them, right? The hand chokes and things of that sort. If, in fact, each of these becomes an occasion for riot, then this country is in perpetual mayhem. The right question for people to ask is, did the public authorities, given the terrible situation that happened, seek to respond to it in the correct fashion? And the answer here is that they did. And given the fact that they made the charges, they did the arrest, they did the firing, and all the rest of this, there's no cause whatsoever to riot. There should be essentially a statement saying, we hope that the Minnesota people keep their eyes on the ball when they're prosecuting this case, and we, of course, will watch it very attentively. The breakdown has come from the fact that the mere commission of an act by an individual is treated as a sign of wholesale dereliction by a department or by a city or by an entire set of institutions known as the police, and that's the inference which we should never tolerate and never encourage.
What we're seeing in a lot of cities now in the wake of these riots is the imposition of curfews to combat these protests from devolving into riots. Obviously, the right to protest enjoys strong constitutional protection, but we're in a strange environment here because not only do you have countervailing public safety concerns with looting and violence, but you've also got public health concerns around COVID-19, which seem to have gone out the window in these cases. So what are the legal limits around state and local authorities' ability to place conditions on these protests, where they're held, when they're held, how they're held?
You know, oddly enough, it turns out there's a weird contrast. In Chicago, there was a religious group that wanted to have an outdoor meeting with spacing observed and so forth, and they were turned down. And this gave rise to a huge brouhaha as to whether or not religious freedom should be able to trump public health. And there was a divided Supreme Court on this, with the Chief Justice writing, I think, a fairly unsatisfactory opinion, indicating why it is that we do not want to second-guess public officials on health matters. Well, this is a real riot. And under these circumstances, the police power to put barricades up, to arrest people, to use various kinds of force, short of deadly force, is going to be perfectly appropriate. In some cases where direct life is being threatened, deadly force itself may turn out to be permissible. So the issue is not whether or not there's legal entitlement to do anything to stop this. The question is just how good are you at managing these sorts of things? And the basic attitude that most people seem to have is that all of the key public officials in many of these major progressive cities have failed very powerfully to do so. And then the question is, well, why do they do this? Well, part of it is some of these people were elected for political reasons and they're not very good at logistics. Everybody knows that Mayor de Blasio in New York is essentially a highly incompetent man who has neither the energy nor the ability to run any complicated organization under any difficult task. He's largely regarded as a kind of a lazy blowhard on the part of most of the public, even those people who tend to support it. But that's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem, I think, is really very deep. and has to be fully understood. If you're a progressive mayor, you essentially share the grievances for which you think the killing of Floyd was a symbol. You believe that the United States is repressive, that racial gulfs are getting wider, that inequality is a major problem in the world, that the banks are ripping everybody else, or to use the phrase of that most unhelpful man, Bernie Sanders, that banks have been looting the United States for 40 years, right? The word looting has a rather different meaning in quotation marks. Well, the problem that these people face is if they are in charge of preserving a city, and they essentially have their intellectual hearts and their emotional ties to the protesters, it's going to be extremely difficult for them to keep a clear-eyed view as to the danger of the short-term mayhem and to take strong and effective steps against it. So one of the things that's so disappointing is you don't hear people saying everybody agrees that the treatment which happened in respect to Floyd is a national tragedy and nobody wishes its occurrence and everybody wishes its punishment. But the riots here are every bit as bad and maybe more so. Every life who was lost to a rioter is as important as the life as Mr. Floyd, including the black policeman who was killed in Oakland by a passerby. There's nobody coming out to say that kind of thing except for Donald Trump. And this is a man whose use of language, shall we say, seems to be inopportune for the occasion. He somehow or other has the right sentiment and the wrong words all the time, so that instead of being able to essentially rally a nation behind him in its, the importance of law and order, a phrase which unfortunately now is needed, what he does is he manages to create another diversion in which he becomes the target of all the abuse instead of that with the rioters. And you can have leadership on the one hand, which is feckless, and on the other hand, which turns out at a different level to be inflammatory. And so what this country is we are now caught between a situation in which we have ineffective governors and mayors, and then we have an ineffective president on the other side. Trump, at least, is trying to get it right. The other people, in my view, simply do not accept the evil of the rioters because they are convinced with the underlying social injustices. But as so many people have said, including the black businesses that have been torched in Minnesota, we're with you on these major issues. Why are you burning down our store? Why are you looting us? Why are you putting us out of business? Why are you jeopardizing our families? And to which there's no answer and no sympathy. I will say the same thing about university presidents and deans. I've seen many of these statements, and I'm frankly, I'm bitterly disappointed by their tone. They all have this fawning sense that, oh my God, the worst thing in the world has happened to George Floyd. Everybody understands that. And then they go on and they say, and this is representative of everything we're doing wrong. It is not. This is one man doing a terrible deed. It is not thousands upon thousands of university students and faculty members, all of whom are deeply opposed to what has happened, who are guilty of complicity with these persons. And then they leave all the stuff about violence and the breakdown of their institutions to one side. And the only thing they can think of doing is strengthening affirmative action programs, which in many places, particularly in places like California, have really gone over the top to the point where nothing else seems to matter with respect to appointment. And we are in a desperate state if the leaders of this particular country cannot defend the institutions of which they are in charge. If they can't keep the integrity of the streets, and they can't keep the integrity of their university processes, but constantly yield to the point that this is a symbol of everything that has gone wrong when it is not a symbol of anything other than one terrible event which everybody condemns. What we have to do is to remember that the old expression is still true. Two wrongs don't make a right. If you commit mayhem after somebody else has committed murder, you have not solved the murder. What you've done is compounded the felony.
Let me ask you about some of the responses coming from the president, which you mentioned. Obviously, most of what we're talking about here falls under the category of state and local responsibilities. But a few days ago, a story started to come out suggesting that people who consider themselves members of Antifa, the radical left-wing organization, were responsible for a disproportionate amount of the violence here. The president went on Twitter and announced that Antifa would be designated as a terrorist organization. Now, best we can tell, Antifa seems to be a pretty loose affiliation. This is not a, really a brick-and-mortar organization. There's not a headquarters anywhere. And it's also, of course, a domestic organization. So what does this mean? Does the president have the power to unilaterally declare this organization a terrorist outfit?
Well, he could declare it anything he wants. The problem that you want to ask is, put it another way, now that he has declared it a terrorist output, what kind of consequence does it have? And this is not like a situation where you start taking away passports and denying people access onto the plane. I think this is a classic illustration of Trump. What he wants to do is to say these people are evil. I think he's right to do that. And then what he tries to do is to call them a terrorist organization. So the battle is over the legality of his designation rather than the immorality of their conduct. I mean, I think what he really should have said is there are large numbers of people who purport to be members of an organization who share common beliefs and are part of work underneath a common symbol, and that they are antithetical to everything that all Americans of all races, creeds, colors, and politics are about, and that to the extent that they are going to be charged with crimes, they cannot plead the nobility of their cause as an excuse for what's happened. It's an aggravating circumstance. Remember what we said, what I said before, rather, about justifications and intent. Police are difficult because they may have specific intent to harm, but they may be justified by the need to prevent various kinds of violence. Well, on the Antifa, so for Antifa, these people certainly have a specific intention to harm, but they have no justifications for their actions. And let me just sort of mention one slogan, which I think sort of captures what's crazy about this, and that's the slogan called "No Justice, No Peace," right? Well, I don't know what they mean by justice. Do they mean, in effect, that unless there's a lynch mob that hangs the offices, there's no justice? I think what they really mean is that we get to determine what's right or wrong, and so long as we have determined that something is wrong in society, we have a perfect right to continue so that nobody else is allowed to live into peace. And nobody but nobody should be allowed to take the law into their own hand. Then there's a second maxim you see on some of the flag, which is called silence is violence. And what people seem to think by that is if everybody doesn't join with them in their full-throated denunciations of various kinds of behaviors, then they are acting in a violent way. And since they are violent by their indifference, we can be violent by breaking their stores and looting people and stopping folks on the street and doing all sorts of horrible things. Silence is violence. It's just not a serious situation. What you're talking about is the use and threat of force. And people who are cowering in their homes are not doing those sorts of thing. They are victims. They're not wrongdoers. So what happens is by putting these maxims together, these groups essentially have guaranteed to themselves a perfect freedom of action to do whatever they want to whomever they want, whenever they want. And that is simply not tolerated in a civil society. And, you know, I'm not a great rhetorician and so forth. I'm not a political leader. But I cannot understand why it is that none of our major people will get up there and take apart the various kinds of arguments that have made and show them to be the utter shams that they turn out to be. This is a genuine American tragedy. We do not have leaders of our major public institutions, our universities, our cities, our states, and so forth, who care enough to defend the organizations of which they are in charge. And so long as they continue to tolerate, then every single mishap, of which there will always be some, will now become the source of national brutalization. And this has got to stop. And I just don't know how to do it. I think the level of disaffection that people have with the legitimacy of their own institutions, the constant hammering by people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders that we're all corrupt, they're all vile, terrible institutions. This has a huge corrosive effect on the way in which the society organizes itself, because it strips decent men and women of the ability to engage in self-defense when their own activities are really subject to major mob kind of violence of the sort that we've seen the last several days.
The final question that I'll put to you, in his remarks yesterday at the White House, the president suggested that he would consider sending in the military into places where the local officials are not being sufficiently forceful in putting down the violence. This is of a piece with suggestions that Senator Tom Cotton has made, that we use the Insurrection Act, which George H.W. Bush invoked in 1992 during the L.A. riots. Now, Richard, I think we've talked in previous installments. I'm not sure why, but I think we've talked I think we've talked about posse comitatus at some point. So there are legal limitations on a president's ability to use the military in domestic context. So two questions, really. To what extent is he hemmed in here, and to what extent does he have, you know, the latitude to act? But also, to what extent do you think he's justified in considering this as an option?
Well, I mean, the general rule for all of this is that the United States government comes in when there's a breakdown of law and order by way of insurrection, and they certainly can supply aid to the states under this. We do have this very complicated militia clause in the Constitution, and one of the things that it says is that the president may call up the militia, now known as the National Guard, into service when there's insurrection in the several states. And there's the Republican form of government clause, which contains in a provision which says that any state can request that the federal government, i.e. the United States, render some assistance to them when they are under some kind of civil stress. And so it's a kind of a tricky question as to whether or not he could act unilaterally, whether or not he has to rely on some kind of an invitation, whether or not he has to make a showdown of the showing of the breakdown in, of law and order in a particular case. Clearly, it would be much better if what he did was to essentially help coach the governors and so forth to handle this on their own. But in the end, if it turns out that they are utterly incapable of doing things correctly, he may well have the right to do this. He should never do something like this unilaterally. He should consult with leaders. He should get the attorney general to write some kind of an opinion. He should then speak to the heads of the states and ask what it is that they think about it and what they plan to do. In other words, he should be circumspect. And there are many words that seem to apply to Donald Trump. Circumspection is not one of them. So I think his instincts are not off base, but my guess is when it comes to the implementation of a program like this, his tendency to move ahead might mangle him. Let me just give one sort of other illustration, which we talked about, because remember, in addition to everything else, there was all the stuff about the offensive tweets, which we haven't mentioned at all. And, you know, Trump said the kinds of things which are not very smart, and then people like the Twitter essentially want to quarantine his tweets, which I think is a big mistake under this. And then the president adopts this executive order, which is designed to change things. Well, the first thing when you read that executive order is you know that Donald Trump did not write it. This is written by a bunch of lawyers. It's very circumspect. They seem to understand the rules. They're complete professionals in the way in which they engage in these kinds of activities. And so what you do is you see the constant irony in this case. There is Trump, the man who turns out to be impetuous, sometimes a man of ill judgment, sometimes a man who complicates things unnecessarily. And then there's the Trump administration, which if you actually read their particular output in these cases, seems to be highly professional in the way in which it starts to do things. And so there's a constant question of when you talk about Trump, whether you're going to get one from column A or one from column B. If it's the president going off half-cocked, Lord protect us from the damage he will do. If it's his department taking a considered position, they might actually help improve the situation. This is the yin and the yang of the Trump administration, and nothing I or anybody else is saying is going to be able to undo that. This is built into the man's DNA. He really does value professional staff, and one of the reasons he values them because he believes he has the right to disregard them at any moment if the whim should happen to seize him.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.